Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for today's Purposeful Planning Institute teleconference. The title of today's call is Parenting the One-Year-Old Millionaire, Instilling Values from Day One. Our guest thought leader today is Jeff Savlov, president of Blum & Savlov Family Business Consulting. And our host today is John Warnick, founder of Purposeful Planning Institute. We do have a number of guests joining us today, so we'd like to just remind everyone that this is an audio-only session. There is no online presentation that you'll need to access, and we do encourage everyone to participate by sharing your questions and comments with us. We'll be taking questions the last 10 to 15 minutes of the call today, and when we reach that point, you'll be able to press the number 1 on your phone to raise your hand, and we'll open your line at that time. As is customary, we'll get started by sharing a purposeful quote, and Jeff sent over a fantastic quote by Gandhi to get us started with today. The real property that a parent can transmit to all equally is his or her character and educational facilities. Parents should seek to make their sons and daughters self-reliant, well able to earn an honest livelihood by the sweat of the brow. So thanks, Jeff, for sharing that with us. And John A., I will turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm pleased to see we have a trial membership offer going right now. I'm pleased to see a number of folks have taken advantage. We've had 20 people sign up for the trial membership, and a number have come this morning to participate in their first live PPI call. These calls, just for the benefit of those who are new to PPI, every one of our calls is archived and recorded. It's accessible at a later date in a searchable database. And I think these calls are just an outstanding way for us to sharpen our skills and sometimes to put new tools in the toolkit. I'm excited about today's conversation with Jeff. Jeff is one of our newer PPI members. He's an exciting addition to our PPI world. We're very proud of each of the members of the Purposeful Planning Institute. But Jeff, in a conversation that we had probably about 6 months ago, shared with me some wisdom that leads us to this call today. And so, Jeff, it is our custom to ask our thought leader guest if he or she would share what we call their purposeful odyssey. That's the story of kind of your educational and professional journey that gets you to where you are today and brings you into our midst. So if you could share that story in the next 3 to 5 minutes, that would be a great way to get this call launched.
Sure. Thanks, John. So I'm going to go back to early childhood, but I promise I won't count every year in between up to the present. That would take too long. But I'll go back to when I was pretty young. My mom was really kind of a hippie, and she was valedictorian in high school, very smart woman, but got married and started having kids right away. So she never really got to live out her kind of hippiness, but was a mom and was really bright and was always reading and was always reading to us. And as early as I can remember, she was just reading these really powerful books. I remember a couple of the books that stand out for me were reading about Martin Luther King, who obviously we know who he is, Jackie Robinson. I believe most people know who he was, the first black baseball player. But she was really into civil rights and instilling in us a sense of what was going on in the world. And these were books that were developmentally appropriate for the age I was at the time, whether it was 5 or 8 or 12. I remember the books were appropriate. They weren't, overly upsetting, but they sort of opened me up to the fact that human beings could be treated really, really awfully simply because of the color of their skin. And she really wanted me to understand what was going on in the world. She was also really interested in gender equality, and so along with civil rights was sort of women's rights. And it just occurred to me this morning, actually, John A., that she had me reading Pippi Longstocking. I don't know if everybody remembers.
Yeah, I love Pippi Longstocking.
Yeah, you know, and I'm thinking, it just occurred to me this morning that that was probably a conscious choice on her part to make sure that I was exposed to books where the protagonist was not just a strong male or just a male of any kind, but this was a really strong female. And it was just this morning that I sort of realized that she probably did that on purpose. When I speak to her later today, I'll kind of check in with her about her what level of consciousness she had about that, but I'm sure it was pretty high. The other hand, my dad was a traditionalist. He was a man of few words, unless he was angry, then you got a few loud words. But he was a pretty quiet guy. But one of the things I remember with him is we would go to New York City in the 70s when I was, again, in elementary school. But I remember we would go to some of these not very expensive Italian restaurants, but they were really traditional and they had great food. And there would often be a line and we'd be waiting outside. And I remember several times where we would be waiting outside and Dad would go in and he'd come out with like a to-go of soup, a to-go container of soup or some food. And I would ask him what he was doing the first time, certainly, and he said, well, just come with me. And he found a homeless person just sitting on the sidewalk and offered it to them, and they took it. And it was incredibly powerful to me to see. You just didn't often see people interacting with homeless folks on the street. And as a young kid, I remember seeing them. I remember being a little freaked out and upset by the fact that these people had no homes, but watching Dad just kind of interact with them and talk to them and give something to them was incredibly powerful. And when I move on and describe some of my later professional experiences, you'll see how deeply that particular one affected me. Kind of moving along, my family was enterprising. We had a commercial printing business in New York City. I was involved with that. We had a second business, printing business in New Jersey. I was involved in that. But my parents were very enlightened in that they didn't really push me to necessarily be involved in it. They really encouraged me to do whatever my passion was. And so without any guilt or, you know, feelings of sort of betrayal, I left the family business because I just wasn't interested in commercial printing. And that was a lucky thing because commercial printing went down the tubes. And I went my own way, and I went into sales and marketing because I really liked people, and I wanted to work with people, and I did really exceptionally well in sales and marketing, but it occurred to me that I was doing well because I just liked people. I was curious about people. I liked having conversations with new people, and people were buying. I was in consumer products. I worked in technology, and they were really sort of buying the stuff that I was talking to them about because they liked me. And I said, you know what, let me really have a career that goes to the heart of what I like, which is really deeply connecting with people. And I went back to graduate school, and I went to a Rutgers Graduate School of Social Work, and I got a Master of Social Work degree, a clinical social work degree. And my first job after that was for the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. And it was working with the homeless. And I had finished my graduate degree. I was interviewing for a clinician position at UMDNJ where I'd be working with homeless mentally ill. And there just happened to be a position which was a bachelor's level position. So it was way beneath my education and it wasn't what I was looking for, but it happened to be open in the program where I was interviewing to be a clinician. And it was a residence position where I would actually live in an apartment building in a pretty bad part of New Brunswick, New Jersey, and I would outreach homeless, mentally ill adults on the streets, try to befriend them and establish some kind of a relationship and get them to move into these apartments where I was actually living. And I think that really goes back to some of the experiences I had with my dad and watching him connect with homeless people and just how deeply internalized that was for me. I didn't realize that until probably sometime this past year, that connection. A lot of these families were extremely poor. And so I've worked with not only some of the extremely wealthy, uber wealthy, and very wealthy families in our country and in the world, but some extremely poor families. While I was working at UMDNJ in an extremely stressful job, I started psychoanalytic training, and eventually I wound up leaving UMDNJ, and I still to this day feel some guilt about it. Because it's a population, you know, the homeless, mentally ill is a population that really needs support. A lot of these folks are veterans, and whether a veteran or not, they're people that are really hurting, and there's just not a lot of safety net there for them. But I just left because I was burnt. It was unbelievably stressful. I had two clients commit suicide my first year out of graduate school, and it was just incredibly draining. You know, I went back and I lived in this apartment building at the end of the day when my colleagues would go home to the suburbs somewhere. I was going to this apartment building on the weekends I was there. There was drug dealing going on. It was really insane, but an unbelievably worthwhile experience. I started a private practice, and I really thought my private practice, being essentially a shrink, was going to be my final career. And it just so happened when I was working, and this is going back about 23 years, that I started working as a full-time psychotherapist. I had a range of families, but I happened to have some families that had operating businesses. I had some families that were extremely wealthy, and it just was very clear to me when I saw these families that, you know, owning things together, when families own stuff together, it affects family relationships, and the family relationships affect the stuff they own together. And going back, 23 years ago, when I thought I finally had a career I was sticking with, and I still do, shrink work 2 days a week, it was clear that there was something different than what a shrink could do for these families, and I started doing consulting work for these kinds of families at the intersection of, family dynamics and emotion and relationships and where it meets shared assets. One of the things that occurred to me in this experience I had with, again, I've worked with very extremely rich families and very, very poor families, is that they both have economic circumstance as a very huge presence in their lives. It's almost like a member of the family. And so where the poor families would really struggle to instill values in their next generation, they were left hoping that there would be some opportunity for their kids to take the values and go forward with and have a chance to live a good life. On the other hand, with the wealthy, they were often awash in opportunity, but they were hoping that there would be enough drive and motivation and independence and selflessness and quality of character. And let's face it, character comes from struggling and failing. And when there's wealth, it can be easy to not struggle and fail. But in both rich and poor, the economic circumstance was a major presence and member of the family. And I would say that any of the ideas that I'm going to talk about today apply to any family, regardless of economic level. The poorest of the poor, middle class, upper middle class, uber wealthy, everything in between, these ideas really apply to any loving parent who loves their child, which I would say is the large, large majority. These ideas apply. But for the purposes of our Purposeful Planning Institute, we're really focusing on sort of families of wealth and privilege and how that affects them. I would add that I did training in child therapy, and that was very, very significant, especially to today's topic. I learned to work with kids doing play therapy as young as 3 years old. My wife, who's the Blum and Blum and Savlov, my firm, she's a psychologist. She doesn't get involved in the family consulting stuff, but she's an extremely talented child therapist, and she works with kids as young as 18 months. Obviously, at that age, she was doing assessments and not really, dream analysis or lay on the couch therapy. But she was very, very talented, and I learned a lot from her as a parent, as a therapist, and all my training in child therapy really opened me up. And this is a point that I really want to make clear, that it really taught me how amazingly deep the world is of even a very young child. Being a child therapist and the training I've had and having to talk to very young children about not only divorce, but either their own cancer or maybe a parent's cancer, has really opened my mind to the incredible power of the inner life of even a very young child and how much potential is there in terms of just communicating and creating meaning with a really, really young person. So I took all of these experiences, as I said, and I started to do consulting work with families. And one of my keen interests in this world is stimulating thought in parents to be. So wealthy parents, people in wealthy families who are getting married and thinking about having kids before they even have kids, to think about some of these issues. And also before a child is even 1 year old, to think about the ideas we're going to talk about today, how to instill values and how to really set up a life that creates an environment to develop the kind of children that you hope to have.
Well, Jeff, that's a wonderful Purposeful Odyssey story. Thank you for sharing it with us. And I think it helps everyone listening to our call today to understand not only the passion that you bring to the subject matter of our call, but also the depth and the breadth of the training and the knowledge that you've devoted to this subject. It's one thing to consult with clients.
It's quite another to be on the front line and facing real-life parenting challenges and opportunities. You mentioned that you are a parent. What have you learned from your role as parent, which prepares you for our conversation today?
Just got to laugh when I think about my role as parent. Let me start off by saying I plan on sharing some successes that I've had as a parent, and I want to make very clear to everyone on the call that my successes are far outweighed by struggles and frustrations and failures, as parenthood often, you know, goes that way. And I'm going to focus on some of the successes, but I certainly wouldn't want to come across as trying to portray that things always go well. They don't, but some of the successes have been pretty cool. And, you know, there's a psychoanalytic concept of, you know, being a good enough parent. And that's what I shoot for, good enough. You know, both of my wife and I, as I've said, we're both shrinks. She hates when I use the word shrink. I think it's kind of a fun word and doesn't sound so medical and technical. She doesn't like it, but I think it's kind of a fun thing to call myself. And we've sort of come to the understanding that we are very likely to drive our kids insane. Shrinks, you know, all the families we know where both parents are shrinks, you know, the kids kind of pay a price for that. And I say that tongue in cheek. We have a good sense of humor. We don't take ourselves too seriously. Being shrinks has sort of made us thoughtful, especially the fact that we work with young children. And so we just a funny aside, when the kids were born and people were like, oh, can we, you know, give money to a college fund? We would say, no, put money into a therapy fund. These kids are goners with shrink parents. And that was always good for a laugh. But in all honesty, we really put our heads together. Both my wife and I were very much values-based people. And we said when we got married and when we decided to have kids, what do we really want? Neither one of us wanted to walk away from our career. We both really passionately wanted to have real quality time with our kids. And so we went 50-50. We pared back our professional lives quite a bit and took a financial sacrifice, which was well worth it. And we both were heavily involved. As a dad, I was often the only father in nursery school, in gymboree or whatever I might be doing, which had its challenges, you know, being the only male, and there were sort of awkward dynamics, but it was a values-based decision. And we really said, how do we want to raise our kids, and what are the values we want to instill, and, you know, what do we really want them to buy into? And it ranged from, you know, my wife and I are both into staying physically active, and we like fitness, so we wanted our boys to be sort of active and not just sedentary, and, you know, we wanted them to eat fruits and vegetables, and these are kind of silly things. There's the big things like, you know, sort of love and family closeness and all of that, but we sort of talked it out. And, you know, on a silly but realistic level, when we would be grocery shopping before we had kids, you go through that cereal aisle. It's colorful, and it's, you know, got a lot of attractive packaging, and all the latest cartoon characters are there. And we would often see, you know, parents trying to get down the aisle with young kids just freaking out, and the kids would be grabbing, you know, Captain Crunch with whatever toy was inside. And we wondered if we could actually raise kids that could walk down this aisle. And this is where, you know, we were like, you know, shrinks, and our kids were like lab rats, is like we said, can we have kids one day and walk down this aisle and have them not freak out and understand that a lot of this colorful stuff and their favorite characters is just about, you know, trying to take the money out of their pocket and make them make a choice that might not be the best nutritional kind of a choice. So there was a variety of things that we put our heads around, from like the deepest level of love and family and wanting kids who would work hard to almost silly things like cereal and certainly fitness and veggies and things like that. And I'd like to say that we are not control freaks. It might sound at this point to people like, man, these guys are nuts. They're like sitting down and trying to design their own child. And it really, I hope it doesn't have that feel at all, and that you can hear the tongue-in-cheek aspect of what I'm saying. I mean, we definitely put our thoughts into what do we want to instill and what kind of, you know, general foundation do we want to have. But there's a big difference between kind of narcissistic parents that you might see at a highly competitive, you know, kids travel sport, where there's always at least a couple of parents trying to live out their, you know, unrealized sports dreams through their kid. And there's a difference between that kind of parent and what I hope my wife and I have achieved, which was trying really hard to instill values, but in a context of freedom of choice and love, but with expectations and accountability kind of all put together.
Well, that is a very important parenting formula. And I think having all of those ingredients as part of the parenting mix is just can't be stressed how important that is, Jeff. I often run into parents who want to rule with edicts. We're coming out of a period where incentive trusts were the rage, and everybody was trying to create another way to micromanage their child's future and to put these carrots out in front of the child at different stages in their life. And when they bring that attitude into the estate planning conversations, I have tried to help enlighten them and help them understand how harmful it is when we rob our children and our grandchildren of the freedom to make their own choices instead of forcing them through financial incentives or constraints to choose the path that we have in mind for them. So thank
you
again.
Go ahead.
No.
Well, and you know, there can be disappointment. Just as an example of what you're saying, you know, I play ice hockey. I still play. I really love it. I played in high school and college, but I never pushed my kids. My older son never had any interest and didn't go that way, and that was fine with me. He played soccer. He's a runner. My younger guy picked it up, and it's kind of exciting, and I'm glad he made that choice. But again, I never pushed it. Well, now he's a freshman in high school, and he's about to try out for the team, and he's decided he's not doing hockey. He's going to do track like his older brother, and he really wants to do it. I would never stand in the way of that. But inside, I'm aware of a bit of disappointment because it was kind of cool that he was into something that I was into, and you could see how, as a parent, easily you could step in and say, you know, no, you've worked too hard, this is important, you must do it. And parents take that route, and I think there's a heavy price to pay. I'm choosing the route of, you know, handling my disappointment and owning it and feeling it, but letting him make his choice to go for track. It's not like he's deciding to just sit around and play his, you know, play Wii, or we don't even own a Wii, or whatever it is he might play, but he's still being active, but he's doing it in his way. And that's what I mean. I set the foundation, my wife and I, which is let's be active, physically active, and they are. I'm not going to pick the sport or throw a fit if he chooses track over hockey. And that's kind of along the lines of what you were just saying with incentive trust.
It is, Jeff, and thank you for those real examples. And it is difficult for parents to let their children make choices that might be different. But it, you know, I love also your emphasis on this enduring power of love. I think it is such an important part of the formula. So let's dive into really what set the hook for me for this conversation. When you and I spent a couple of hours in several phone conversations 6 months ago, you shared what kind of were four basic parenting principles, which are so simple, but as I heard them resonated so powerfully with me. Could you share those four principles with us and give us some practical insights into just how early, you mentioned before that, you know, some of your work in child therapy helped you see we can start earlier, but how early do you think we can begin to utilize some of these concepts in our parenting?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you, going back again to the child therapy work, you know, it's research shows that it's really important to do the, you know, the goo 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 and booty 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 booty, hey buddy, and all those cute little vocalizations that we do with like little infants. Those are really important. But it's also important to just speak in full sentences, even to a child that's only 4 or 5 months old. The cute little noises are essential, but don't hesitate to just sort of speak normally in full sentences, and the brains of these amazing little humans will suck that up. And we did it a lot more with our first child because we only had one. We didn't do it as much. You know, it's kind of like the first child, the food falls on the floor and, you know, you don't pick it up. The second child, you just kind of blow it off and you let him eat it regardless of where it fell. With our first child, we really did a lot of the gooby gooby gooby, and we also did the talking. And he was talking like a fiend at like even 10 months. So the things I'm going to talk about now, these four sort of principles, are things you can start really even at, you know, 7, 8, 9 months, but certainly when they're starting to verbalize, they're important. But it's like you said, it's ridiculously simple. I mean, this is not rocket science. I almost am embarrassed to say them out loud because they're so basic, but I'm going to talk about the just how powerful they are and how important it is to be conscious in implementing these. But it's please. It's thank you, it's I'm sorry, and the final is what I call the golden sippy cup rule. Please is really as simple as respect. It broadens the world of the child beyond themselves to understand that there are other people that do not have to do everything that they might need. Now, ideally, right, when you have a newborn, they poop in their diaper, they cry, and they expect the diaper to be changed pretty quickly, and a good parent's going to do that. If they're hungry, they cry, and they get fed, and a good parent's going to do that. Well, we know people in their 60s and 70s who still pretty much act the same way, right, John? You know, they expect when they are uncomfortable, other people are going to, you know, serve them. And part of getting that little child into sort of the world of a adult of character is for them to understand that people don't have to do things just because you're asking. And please is an absolute simple, hopefully most parents are doing it, way of showing respect for another person, respect for the fact that they are separate and different and that your needs are different than theirs and that they don't have to do things for you. And saying please is amazing. So it's really important with very young children. Again, uber wealthy, super poor, anyone in between, these are all really, really helpful. But I think, as you know, we all know in sort of purposeful planning and the worlds that we work in, that the challenges that wealthy families face around, you know, entitlement and motivation and character and hoping to raise people who are selfless and compassionate, that it's extra important to put emphasis on this. And again, people might there, you know, out here on the call might think, well, isn't that just standard practice? Who doesn't? There's a wide range of how much people really force young children to say please. And I think if you can start as soon as children are able to, even if they're not speaking yet or they just have mama and dada, you can, you know, when they're reaching for something, you can just help them. You can say, please, please, and then give it to them so that they learn that they're supposed to say please before they ask for it. And it really has a major, major impact on development, character development. Same thing, thank you. Number two, thank you is about gratitude. Number one is respect. You don't have to do this for me. Number two is thank you. You did it for me. Okay, and hopefully I said please and you did it for me, so I was respectful to you. Now I want to say thank you, which is gratitude. It's teaching kids that when people do things that they don't have to do for you, that you can show gratitude and you can express it directly, and that's a really wonderful thing to do. The third one is I'm sorry, remorse. My behavior can affect your feelings. I can do things that can hurt you. I might physically hurt you. I might hurt your feelings. But helping children to find the situations in which they need to say I'm sorry and making sure that they say it and they understand it, you know, unless you have a sociopath who feels no remorse, which is an incredibly small part of the population, children are capable of understanding at a very young age I'm sorry and what it means and how to use it. The final one is the golden sippy cup rule. When our kids were old enough to hold their little sippy cup and also walk at the same time, we started making them, showing them how to take their empty cup and walk over to the sink and reach up and put it on the sink, or walk over to the dishwasher and put it in there. And a little bit after that, to take a little step stool and walk up the step stool to the sink. And obviously they didn't do a great job because their motor skills weren't there, but to take the sponge and the sink and the soap and to try to wash it out. Now, could we have done it easily? Yes, much more easily than they could have. And it took more time, and that's the thing, it took more time to walk them through the process of getting over to the sink, especially when they weren't cooperating, and going up onto the stool and grabbing the sponge, especially when they weren't into it. It took more time, and life's busy. It would have been easier to just grab the thing, throw it in the dishwasher, and go. But that's where the rubber hits the road, because that shows them that you are responsible for your world, that it's not just going to all be done for you, and that, you know, when you set that kind of expectation at 10 or 12 months that I drank this, it's empty, I need to clean it. I mean, just think about the situations in the rest of adult life. And we all know people who never really got that lesson. And this is just a wonderful lesson to get in there. So, you know, please, thank you, I'm sorry, the golden sippy cup rule. It's not rocket science, but I can tell you that when it's not there and when it's not consciously there on the part of the parents, there's a big impact. And there really is a wide range for how people implement these things. I was very involved, as was my wife, because we did sort of the 50-50 parenting. We both got to go to elementary school. we got to go to kindergarten, and you know, they had parent volunteers come in and read books with the children. So you'd take a little couple little chairs into the hallway, and whatever level the child was on, you would take a book at their level and you would read with them, and this is how parents got to volunteer. Well, there were kids that would come out, a couple that were at this level, a couple of children that would come out, look me in the eye and say, "Hi, Mr. Savlov," with a smile. "Hi, Mr. Savlov," which is a wonderful thing to get from an adorable little five-year-old. They'd read the book, and at the end, they would say, "Thank you, Mr. Savlov," and go back in. And I can't tell you how my heart went out to these cute, they were all adorable little kids, but to have them look in your eye and say, "Good morning, Mr. Savlov," and say, "Thank you, Mr. Savlov," at the end was really, I mean, they were pulling me into their world, and they had me around their finger. They really were engaging me in a significant way. That was not the majority. Some kids would say hello or thank you, some wouldn't, and some kids wouldn't say anything at all. And I got to see through volunteering in elementary school, I volunteered heavily in middle school, high school, they kind of pushed the parents out, but through my sons who are both in high school now, I see their friends, and I'm just involved in the community through coaching. I've seen a lot of these kids from kindergarten all the way up through high school, and I see these kids that really had a little something different at home. There was something around the please and the thank you and the politeness and the connection that they had, and the respect that they showed and the gratitude that went with these kids through high school. And the kids in kindergarten that were a little bit, you know, less likely to use these kinds of things or a little bit more rude, it stayed with them. And so this isn't, you know, high-level academic research, but it there's a lot of truth in it for me, and I've just seen how I could tell what the parents were doing at home. You could see the parents who are committed to teaching their children that they're not alone, that there are other people in the world, that you need to respect them. You can see it in kindergarten, and you can see how it is there or continues to be missing even in high school. So as simple as all this stuff is, I mean, it's not rocket science, right? Most parents do the please and the thank you, but if you do it in a really conscious, focused way, it's incredibly powerful, and it's character building.
Well, I love what you just shared, Jeff. Thank you so much. And I think one of the other simple but profound lessons that I gained from you in our earlier conversations was around the importance of always being vigilant for the opportunities, because you never know quite when they're going to arise. Sometimes you can intentionally create them, but being aware of opportunities where we can teach and instill values in our children. And of course, I think as parents, that means we need to have clarity around what matters most to us. But once we do have a vision around the type of adults we hope our children will become, we just shouldn't stand back and magically wait for that to happen. Can you kind of give us some suggestions on the ways in which we can successfully instill values in young children once they've moved out of, say, the toddler stage, just a little bit beyond toddler? What are some other suggestions that you'd give at that stage?
Yeah, I mean, again, in most of life, I would say don't sweat the small stuff. But when it comes to raising children, the small stuff, certainly there's a time not to sweat the small stuff. When it comes to these kinds of opportunities to instill values, the small stuff can be really powerful, just like the please and thank you. When our kids got a bit older and could understand more, we explained to them about the cereal aisle. And we ask them, you know, what do you think's going on here? There's your favorite character. There's your favorite character on a colorful box and, you know, a prize inside. And we would have these conversations about how they were trying to get you to take the money out of your pocket or mom and dad's money and buy this, but was it a good choice? And we taught them about the ingredients. And again, they were, you know, a little bit past the toddler stage, but able to understand this. And we would say, well, let's look at the ingredients. There's a lot of ingredients here, and typically a lot of ingredients is less healthy than a few ingredients. We would point out things like artificial colors and artificial flavors, and it really is not inaccurate to say, look, these artificial colors, these are like your fingers. finger paints. The finger paints are non-toxic. You could technically, kids can eat finger paints and not die. You can eat Fruity Pebbles and not die. However, they're really pretty similar. And so we sort of explained this to them in a way that hopefully didn't traumatize them. And I don't think it did, but they came to really understand that, okay, the colorfulness and my favorite, you know, the Wiggles. My younger son was into the Wiggles, these Australian kids musical group. And the, all of that is trying to make me make a choice. Is this a good choice? And our kids were able to go past all of those colorful boxes and all the prizes that they really wanted and get to sort of the healthy section where there's really nothing all that colorful and there's like four ingredients, you know, whole wheat and, you know, rocks and grass or whatever it is in the healthy cereal. But they got it, and it wasn't a struggle. It wasn't a struggle. We weren't fighting like those parents we saw before we had kids. We simply explained to them, here's the reason. Do you really want it? It's stuff that's really not good for you, and we know that it, scientists know that this can hurt you. Why don't we get something that tastes good that's healthy for you? So just by explaining to them, broccoli, we wanted kids, and I, you know, we're not talking about, you know, these high-level concepts. You know, I want you to be a rocket scientist or an engineer. We're talking about broccoli. It's a superfood. If you're going to eat a vegetable, broccoli is a really good choice. Could we get our kids to really love broccoli? So we ate a lot of broccoli while they were growing up, and we would, you know, my wife and I would eat the broccoli, and we would make muscles and pretend like, you know, we just got strong like Popeye, and then they would do it, and they would make muscles, and we did it together. We had a lot of fun with it. My younger sister has younger children, and then, you know, me and my wife and my sons, we do the broccoli and muscles with my younger sister's kids, and she swears they would never eat broccoli, they hate vegetables, but when they come to our house, they love broccoli, and they make muscles, and they eat vegetables. So it's really just about engaging, it's about having fun, it's not about edicts, like you say, it's not about lecturing, it's about taking what's really important. What's the foundational elements? What are the foundational elements? And how can you make, you know, have a good time and walk the walk as parents? Another concept I kind of talk about is doors to the future. There's a lot of ways in which doors, literally doors, have opportunity. My wife and I are into egalitarianism. And so we don't teach our boys that you should open a door for a girl. And I know some people out there might be upset by this, but the way we look at it and our values are such that we say, you know what, if you can open the door for another human being, old or young, male or female, that's a really nice bit of love to put into the world. It's small. It's not saving, you know, the world from poverty and hunger, but you know what, it's a little bit of love. And if you have the chance, do it. And so when we would see somebody getting to a door, you know, ahead of us somewhere, we would playfully say with our post-toddler kids, hey, let's see who can get there first and open the door for that, you know, couple over there. And we'd run over and open it, and it got to be like a fun thing. Who could get there first? The couple or whoever the people were that we held the door open for always got a kick out of it. And the boys kind of learned to have fun opening doors for other people regardless of gender. What's interesting is when they got to middle school, the bus driver was this very sort of traditionalist older guy, really nice guy, but a traditional guy. And when he first pulled up to the bus stop for my boys and with my older son, who was there first, he opened the door and boys and girls sort of just made a dash for the bus. And he was like, whoa, 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 everybody back up. Ladies first, guys do the right thing. And so the world doesn't always cooperate with what it is you're trying to teach them. And my sons were like, they came back that day and were like, you should have seen what the bus driver did. He made the girls go first. Like, they never saw anything so outrageous. But it was, you know, it's kind of interesting. And he was a great guy, and they really liked him a lot. But the world doesn't always cooperate. But doors have a really, it's a wonderful opportunity. Subways and elevators. In New York City, and I think most of the world, I don't know about the whole world, but certainly with elevators, right, you typically let the people who are in the elevator exit, and then you enter. And I see kids all the time, their parents with kids, the doors open, and they just sort of fly in between everybody's legs. We taught our kids, this is how it works. First, these people come off, then you go on. We took our kids to the New York City subway. How does it work? Everybody sort of stands aside. You let everybody get off the subway. Then you punch, kick, and scream and scratch the eyes out of the person next to you and work your way onto the subway. And that's how it works. But, you know, there's just opportunities all over the place. Another example I'd throw out there of, you know, how it doesn't always go so well is we, you know, a friend of mine was talking to me about his daughters who were just really not in identifying with their Jewishness, and that was really important to them. When we go to the same synagogue, and he was just kind of talking to me about it, and I said, you know, you guys live right across the street, and you often send your daughters, like on Saturday, they had to get their certain number of, you know, going to Shabbat services in order to earn their bat mitzvah or whatever. I said I would be there with my kids because they were earning theirs for their bar mitzvah, but I would see your girls come in without you. I said, you know, how do you expect them to really internalize this sense of Jewishness if you guys really don't like it and would rather stay home and just read the paper and do whatever, and you're just sort of sending them when you live so close? Don't you think it would make a much bigger impact if you went with them and, you know, either enjoyed it together or find a way to enjoy it together, or if services are too boring, find another Jewish thing to do that's both Jewish and fun? But that's just a really important point about sort of walking the walk, and not in an obligatory way, but because my parents tried to instill Jewishness in me through kind of obligatory stuff, and they weren't enjoying the long services, and I wasn't enjoying it, and it really didn't go all that well. And I got my sort of a Jewish identity through almost an accident, which is kind of a topic for another time, but it was sort of a summer camp experience that was really incredible. But walking the walk and doing it in a fun way. If it's just obligatory and you're trying to get your kids to enjoy something that you hate or just really are not satisfied with, they will smell that like a dog smells fear.
Jeff, you made the comment earlier that a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of parenting principles or axioms to kind of guide us as parents, I'd like to think that this applies to grandparents as well as parents. You made the point that the roles are different, obviously, but I think there's a lot of opportunities for grandparents to positively reinforce what parents are doing. And I often talk about grand monsters. Those grand monsters come in two sizes and shapes. One are the young entitled grandchild that really views both parent and grandparent as an ATM machine. But the other is the grand monster, the grandparent, who interferes with the parenting, intentional and positive parenting, maybe unknowingly or sometimes very consciously. So, but we're now going to enter a space in this conversation where what we're going to talk about is specifically aimed at wealthier families, where so much of what we've talked about up until now really could be applied at any spectrum of wealth. But could you help us understand some of the ways in which wealthy parents need to be very careful about the bigger decisions that they make because of how those decisions might undermine their efforts to instill the proper values in their children they'd like to see the children emulate?
Yeah. Right, and it's true that everything we've talked about so far really applies to every family, with sort of the special, all the special circumstances that go around with significant wealth and all of that we always talk about. A couple of things that are, you know, exceptionally important in families of wealth have to do with nannies and where you decide to live. You know, in terms of the nanny, that's a big decision. I would say that you can't completely give over raising of your children to someone else and hope it goes the way that you want, even if it does work out well. You know, it depends about what your values are. And for the purposes of Purposeful Planning Institute and the kinds of families that we're, you know, hopefully working with, and what families want, if you really want to have a nice connection with your children and a close family and for children to learn from your values firsthand from you, you need to spend time with them. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody should do what my wife and I did and go 50-50 and take the financial hit, or that everybody should have a stay-at-home parent. There's all kinds of ways of doing it, and certainly plenty of parents do an excellent job of all this when they're both working and super busy. I saw some research, I believe it was in the New York Times, I could probably dig it up if anyone's interested and get some contact with me, but there was research done that shows that there was actually the time that super busy parents, where both parents were working, the time they spent with the kids was actually much more focused and just quality, and they measured quality in some scientific relational way, but it was actually better quality time because the parents were so busy and they missed the kids so much that when they had that opportunity, they were really focused, whereas the parents who were stay-at-home were just so overwhelmed and seeing the kids all over the place that it was easy to sort of cook and the kids are in the other room, and then, you know, return emails and the kids are in the other room. And I know this. I mean, I'll sort of, one of the many foibles that I can attest to is, yes, I sort of cut back to 50% and cut back my professional life, but I'm a victim of what I just described. There were times where, yeah, I was home, but I was cooking or I was trying to, you know, give the kids a bath, and then I was just running off to whatever, and the emails are still going in and out. And so just to give a little plug for dual income parents where they're both working and have successful careers, there is research to show that there's a level of quality time that can occur there that is better quality time. There might be more time overall, more volume with the sort of the stay-at-home folks, but it might not be as good quality. The moral of the story is, in almost any situation, if you put your mind to it, you can have the quality time, but you've got to be conscious about it. So with the nanny, some people do choose to have a nanny. And one of the things to think about is making sure you have a nanny that you can explain what you're trying to achieve with your children and explain it to them. Again, I'll use my personal experience as an example. Before we did our sort of total 50-50, we tried bouncing back and forth with a nanny, and we found that the nanny kept cleaning up our son's toys for him. She felt like we were paying her, she should clean up the toys. She was just a really good, hardworking young lady, and she wanted to earn her money. And we had to explain that we wanted her to help our son do it. And it was really when we sat her down and explained, no, the reason we're doing this is we appreciate that you're hardworking. We appreciate that you want to earn your money. That's all wonderful. But what we're trying to achieve is we want to raise a son who's going to know how to take care of himself. He's not going to expect other people to, you know, wipe his butt, so to speak. And when she really understood, she thought it was really cool. It was a little bit different from the way she was brought up, but she totally bought into it. And then she would help him, you know, do whatever he could himself, and then she would, you know, do the rest. But she would keep him involved. And when she understood what we were trying to achieve, she felt like she was kind of a member of the team and that she was doing this really cool kind of project with our little human to make him, you know, a respectful and just a quality little guy. And so it's not that nannies are bad, but you really need to take the time to make sure you communicate to a helping professional, a helping nanny, a child care person, what it is that's important to you, and really give specifics, because you can give sort of words around these things and they don't necessarily, you don't know if the person's going to really get it, but if you can operationalize it, like make sure they put their sippy cup in the sink every time, make sure they at least put most of their stuff away, and if they read books, they put them back on the shelf, those kinds of things, that can really make a big difference. Another one, which is, you know, I think it's kind of a charged issue, but it's like, where are you going to live? You can live wherever you like. And I'm not telling people where they should live, and I'm certainly my clients, I don't tell them where they should live. But if you're trying to put together a package here that's going to create an environment for the kind of foundation that we're talking about here, there are different places to live. There are very wealthy towns that the houses are huge and the cars are expensive, and the kids, as soon as they get licenses, get very expensive brand new cars. And then there are also wealthy towns that have great school systems, but maybe the houses aren't quite as big. There aren't, you know, the cars are more like Volvos instead of, you know, Maseratis or Mercedes or whatever it might be. And there's a culture to these different towns. And it's worth looking into some of the towns to see which one fits the kinds of values that you are trying to instill. Now, I've certainly worked with families and known families in extremely wealthy towns with fancy cars and big houses and estates, and the kids were really amazing kids because the parents really put their nose to the grindstone and they worked hard at it. It's just a lot harder to pull that off when you're surrounded by people who've got lots of material wealth and they're not living in sort of the same values context that you are. So certainly people should live wherever they want, but it can make a big difference. And, you know, I am not wealthy. I wouldn't call myself wealthy. We're solidly, I think, upper middle class. And again, I don't think it sort of matters. Any parent looking for the same thing, but when we were looking to buy a home, we looked at different towns, and it was really amazing, you know, especially when we went sort of by like the high schools and we were looking at the school systems, and you could get a sense when you look at the high schools that we didn't want to be in a town where the kids were all boom, you got your license, you're getting a brand new really expensive car. We wanted to be in a town where there were really good school systems and the schools were really great, but that where people sort of lived a more simple life. I actually live just outside of Princeton, not in Princeton proper, but sort of like a suburb of Princeton. But Princeton's an amazing example where there's incredible international wealth and some very, you know, uber wealth. But there's this sort of culture of it. It's more about education and succeeding in terms of intellectual success than financial. And people are super laid back. Even on some of like the more important holidays at our synagogue in the heart of Princeton, people will come and like, you know, sandals and jeans, and it's more this sort of laid back, you know, try really hard in school kind of culture, but big giant houses and expensive cars aren't what we're all about. And so there's like a town culture that's was sort of really a good fit for us. Again, we're in the suburbs of that, but it's the same kind of a thing. So the opportunity for everything we've talked about so far is tremendous for legacy families, for wealthy families. I find families sort of look at me cross-eyed when I bring up some of this stuff sometimes because, you know, if you look at the history of sort of the purposeful planning in general, that kind of planning, you know, it's taken a while to get from, you know, say nothing until you die and then everybody finds out what you get, and now we're at the point where we're engaging people. You know, it's pretty enlightened and kind of best practice-y to include, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-olds in family councils and family meetings and educational things. But I think the next way for those that really want to sort of be enlightened and sophisticated is to really think before you have kids, talking to young adults in these families before, as they're getting married, as they're thinking about kids, about these kinds of issues, because there are decisions to be made before you even have kids that are going to affect kids, like where you're going to live and are you going to both work, are you going to get a nanny, and certainly when you have the children, to really have a conscious mindset. Even people in my own family, my own siblings, have very different styles with sort of the please, thank you, and it shows in the children and the cousins, even notice it in one another, sort of the demanding without a please versus the please and thank you. And so this is really just important stuff, and I think there's a tremendous opportunity to go way below the 16, 17 in these kinds of families and really take it down to the earliest stages of life.
Well, Jeff, thank you for that vision of what the possibilities are. I think it excites all of us. Those who've been with us, I'd love to invite you now if you have a question for Jeff, if you have an affirming story or experience that would be an exclamation point on one of the suggestions or points he's been making, we'd love to hear from you. You can enter our conversation by pressing 1 on your touchtone phone. And I'm going to first hand I see up is Kristen Keffler's hand, and then we'll go to Susan Axelrod. So, Kristen, you're live on PPI.
Hey, Johnny, thank you. And thank you, Jeff, for all that you have shared today. My question is actually coming from a personal, me with my personal hat on rather than my professional hat. The thing that I'm really curious about, I have a 2.5-year-old, and I'm, you know, the whole idea of please and thank you and looking people in the eye and has been something we've worked on since she was itty-bitty. The thing that I think is really interesting is that there are times, and particularly with one of her grandparents, that she does a little power play where, you know, I'll say, hey, tell grandma, thank you, thanks for having me over, and she'll refuse to do it. And I think it's an interesting thing, and I've decided just not to do the power play game, but I'm, you know, that's something that is, I can imagine it's just something that's probably pretty typical, but I'm curious what your feedback is on that, because at some point it feels like you still want to instill the value and ask them to take the action, but if they refuse, you don't want to make it such a big thing that it's just about the action without the feeling behind it.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. I think in that situation you can say, well, you know, Daddy and I are going to say thank you to Grandma and give her a big hug and a kiss because she, you know, spent a lot of time with you and we really appreciate it. And you give Grandma a hug and a kiss in front of her and say, maybe next time, you know, you'll feel more comfortable doing it yourself, and just leave it at that. And they can see that you're walking the walk and leave it alone. And other times there might be an opportunity to say, well, it's really important to say thank you. And if there's some way to, Grandma's letting you take this gift she gave you, we're going to have to leave the gift here with Grandma unless you say thank you, because it's really that important when somebody gives you something. Mm-hmm. So you can just sort of step in and model it and completely forego the power struggle, or you can take away something if there's, you know, the logistics are there, like a little gift, and say, you really can't have a gift unless you do the right thing. That's just not how it works. And then you could have a screaming fit, and they still might not say thank you. And it doesn't always work perfectly, believe me. But those are two things that sort of come to mind. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I love the idea. And I love the idea of modeling it, without making it a big deal, but modeling it or saying there are consequences for not showing gratitude, for not being respectful, that just things get taken away. That seems very, very doable.
Yeah, and I might even add, you could ham it up with Grandma and give Grandma a big hug, and then Grandma hugs you back, and you say, man, this is a great hug. This is one of the best hugs. Man, wouldn't you love a hug like this? And then the kid might run and say, I want Grandma. Thank you, Grandma, and give you a big hug. But you gotta get creative in the moment, and sometimes you're going to lose. I could give you many more examples of me losing. I just, like I said in the beginning, was trying to show some of the successes, but there's plenty of times where you accept loss. You just, if you do it regularly, then you're creating a monster. If you accept it once in a while, you're just a reasonable person and raising a kid.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kristen, very much. Susan, you're live on PPI.
Hi, John A. Thanks. Hey, Jeff.
My
husband is a child psychologist, shrink, as you call him. And periodically I'll get a text from him that says busy day at the office with a picture of a Lego tower as tall as he is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, really? That's what you're doing today? So he also does work with, very young children. This was a wonderful call. I wanted to say, I feel like an idiot, but, you know, for you to draw the connection between please, showing respect, thank you, showing gratitude, and I'm sorry, showing remorse. It's very powerful. So we as adults can really understand, you know, all the amazing, incredible impact of respect, gratitude, and remorse. But I really just wanted to encourage you, and I'm, you know, I'm like your new missionary. Because these are things that I teach in very simple ways. It doesn't matter. But so I just really wanted to say thank you for showing me through the use of such simple tools how I can really draw, you know, help them cross the bridge as they, mine are grown, you know, now, but to help my own at their ages and any age cross the bridge. So thank you very, very much for that.
Thanks, Susan. No, I appreciate it because I was a little concerned about, wow, I'm gonna get with all these, you know, really trained, successful, smart professionals and tell them, you know, please, thank you, I'm sorry. Like, could it be any more simple? But the truth is, and I appreciate the validation you're giving me, is that it is that powerful. If you want appreciation and respect and remorse, which are major building blocks of good character, you got to start
right
at the beginning. So thanks for that.
Exactly. Let me tell you something. My daughter was at one of the colleges where there was a shooting on Friday. And so it was, there was a lot, and I happened to be in over the weekend with a place where there was a lot of people. And so it was endless conversation because, as you know, there were two shootings, two college students killed by guns in a, you know, place, whereas my husband, again, texted me, nice conflict resolution skills, you know. So these things, if we can start them at two-year-old, you know, two-, three-, four-year-olds, and really help them understand as they grow, I hope and pray that we'll begin to see a difference in our world, and you're helping to do that. So thank you. I look forward to meeting you in person. I really, really hope to see you at Rendezvous No pressure.
Me too. We'll look forward to it. Yeah, I was there. My first one was this past August, but I'll be there next year. So.
Okay. Well, I'll for sure see you there. Okay. Thanks, John.
Great.
Thank you, Susan. Jeff, I'd love to get your reading recommendations before we say goodbye this morning. I think our listeners would benefit from knowing what inspires you in this arena.
Yeah, sure. Silver Spoon Kids is a book by Eileen and John Gallo. She's, a shrink, and he's a lawyer, I believe. I got that right. And that looks at sort of kids and values and money and preventing entitlement in a way that's really digestible and good quality, and I would say that in a more sort of passionate spiritual way. I just read Gandhi's autobiography. Actually, I finished it 2 months ago, and I was incredibly enraptured with this book. I mean, this is a guy who lived by values when it was hard, when it was painful, when it meant, you know, imprisonment, and he stuck by what he believed was truth. And values and good values of treating people well and spreading love. And I was saying to you earlier, John, I read the book except for the last 8 pages because I didn't want to say goodbye to this guy. And I left the book sitting around for probably two and a half months because I was sad to be done with it. And so just a couple of days ago, I sat down, I read the last 8 pages and felt the sadness, but finished it off. And so it's Gandhi, an autobiography, the story of my experiments with truth. It's the authorized American edition. There's a lot of editions, but really, really deeply moving. Got a lot out of it, so love it.
Thank you for both of those recommendations, Jeff. This has been a wonderful conversation this morning.
Yeah, thanks everyone for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, everybody.